From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
So last night, CBS refused to air MoveOn.org's winning advertisement in our Bush in 30 Seconds contest. And our question really was, you know, how does this not constitute essentially censorship? If CBS has a monopoly on the Super Bowl, you know, why isn't this just a case of CBS refusing to air dissenting opinions on TV?
Today, we'll speak with Eli Pariser, co-founder of MoveOn.org, about the big ad that CBS refused during the Super Bowl, as well as the other contestants.
We know Saddam Hussein has dangerous weapons today, and we do, Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa. The Battle of Iraq is one victory in a war on terror that began on September the 11th, 2001.
Just one of the MoveOn.org ads. And finally, Dennis Kucinich. The New York Times says he should pull out of the debates. He has his own comments.
It is a great burden for a media executive to be charged with the responsibility of picking the next president of the United States.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In nearly simultaneous strikes on Sunday, a pair of suicide bombers set off explosives during Muslim holiday celebrations inside two buildings housing offices of the main Kurdish parties in northern Iraq, killing at least 67 people and wounding more than 200. The blast killed senior members of the two parties, the Kurdistan Democratic Party and the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, which are among the best organized and most staunch U.S. allies in Iraq. Both groups supported the invasion that toppled Saddam Hussein and put their large militias at the service of U.S. commanders. The attacks in the crowded auditoriums at the KDP and PUK headquarters came on the first day of the celebration commemorating the Quran's account of God allowing Abraham to sacrifice a ram instead of his son Ishmael. The blasts are believed to be the first major strikes in Iraq in which the assailants strapped explosives to their bodies. Most suicide bombings in Iraq have involved explosives packed into cars or trucks. The dead included the deputy prime minister of the Kurdish North, the KDP regional director for Erbil, the city's mayor and his deputy, and the chief of police were also killed. The PUK dead included the top representative for Erbil. In the attack Sunday, the bombs were synchronized to detonate at 10:30 a.m. when large crowds gathered at both headquarters and pressed into the small auditoriums as people wound in a large line to greet the dignitaries. Senior administration officials said over the weekend that President Bush will establish a bipartisan commission in the next few days to examine U.S. intelligence operations, including what's being described as a study of possible misjudgments about Iraq's unconventional weapons. The president's decision came after a week of rising pressure on the White House from both Democrats and many ranking Republicans to deal with what the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee has called egregious errors that overstated Iraq's stockpiles of chemical and biological weapons and made the country appear far closer to developing nuclear weapons than Iraq actually was. Bush's agreement to set up a commission to study the Iraq intelligence failures was first reported in the Washington Post on Sunday. The pressure to establish the commission intensified after David Kay, the former chief weapons inspector, told the Senate Armed Services Committee last week that, quote, it turns out we were all wrong, probably, about the perceived Iraq threat, which was the administration's basic justification for the invasion. The commission will not report back until after the November elections. Some former officials who've been approached about taking part say they believe it may take a year and a half or more to reach its conclusions. The draft of the executive order specifically orders the commission to compare intelligence about Iraq with what was found on the ground there. But it's not clear whether the commission will decide to delve into issues beyond how the intelligence was gathered and specifically how it was used. In the case of Iraq, that could put the commission into the midst of the politically charged question of whether the most dire sounding possibilities were de-emphasized by Bush administration officials to build a national and international consensus on the need to take military action. The White House has denied any such effort to filter the intelligence. Dana Milbank of The Washington Post reports Bush aides have learned through hard experience that admitting error only projects weakness and invites more abuse. Conversely, by postponing an acknowledgement, possibly beyond Election Day, the White House is generating a fog of uncertainty around Kaye's stark findings and potentially softening a harsh public judgment. Former Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix said, quote, "They aren't giving up. They all to prefer to retreat under a mist of controversy rather than say, I'm sorry, this was wrong." More than a third of Iran's parliament resigned on Sunday to protest a sweeping ban on candidates running in the parliamentary election later this month. The defiant move threatened to plunge Iran's political system into chaos. One by one, angry lawmakers who have held a three-week sit-in at the huge parliament building marched up to the podium and handed their resignations to the speaker. In an emotional statement read aloud during the session of parliament on Sunday and broadcast live across the nation on Iranian radio, the members who resigned accused powerful conservatives of seeking to impose a religious dictatorship like that of the Taliban, who were overthrown by U.S.-led forces in Afghanistan. The mass resignation coincided with what was supposed to be a day of national celebration, the 25th anniversary of the return to Iran of Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini from exile in France. The cleric led a popular Islamic revolution that brought an end to the monarchy and ushered in an Islamic republic. The resignations came a day after the president announced his negotiations with senior religious officials had failed to resolve the crisis. And at least 244 people were trampled to death and hundreds more were hurt on Sunday under the crush of worshippers in one of the deadliest disasters during the annual Muslim pilgrimage to Saudi Arabia. Democratic Senator John Kerry Saturday rejected charges. His votes in the U.S. Senate were influenced by campaign contributions, saying he'd spent his whole career battling special interests. Speaking to reporters after accepting the endorsement of Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm, Kerry said he would put his record up against any of the Democratic candidates seeking the chance to run against President Bush in November. Michigan holds a primary next Saturday. Kerry's now making a 7-state campaign swing in advance of the Democratic contest on Tuesday. But the reports that he'd accepted thousands of dollars in contributions from lobbyists dogged him through the day, which he began in Missouri before a boisterous rally, launching his own attack on Bush for allowing, quote, lobbyists and special interests to influence White House policy. Criticizing Kerry, Dean told reporters in Tucson, "It turns out we've got more than one Republican in the Democratic race." Dean said, "I've already said I thought retired General Wes Clark was a Republican. Now apparently John Kerry has the same financing habits." Meanwhile, according to an MSNBC Reuters Zogby poll released on Sunday, John Kerry holds wide leads in Missouri and Arizona and a narrow lead in Oklahoma and has moved into a virtual tie in South Carolina 2 days before key presidential contests in those states. Israel's security fence built to halt Palestinian terrorism, Israel says, is outside the jurisdiction of the International Court of Justice, and the court should immediately recuse itself from the case. This according to Senator Hillary Clinton. She said this fence is a legitimate response by a sovereign nation to protect its citizens from terrorist attacks. Surrounded by Jewish leaders and former New York City Mayor Ed Koch, Clinton issued rare praise for the Bush administration for opposing the court's decision to review the legality of the barrier. She also lauded Israel for building the fence, which she described as a restrained defensive measure against terrorism. Critics of the barrier call it the apartheid wall. South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu appealed to a U.S. court to allow apartheid victims' claims for compensation from foreign companies to proceed. This according to the Independent newspaper. South African government, fearing a loss of foreign investments, has opposed the multi-billion dollar lawsuits filed against major companies in U.S. courts. And BBC reporter Andrew Gilligan resigned Friday after a judicial inquiry repudiated his reporting that the British government, quote, sexed up intelligence on Iraq. He's the third BBC resignation prompted by the harsh criticism. The controversy has sent a chill through British media, with senior journalists warning it could impede tough investigative reporting. In a statement, Gilligan apologized for mistakes in his May 2003 story and said his departure was at his own initiative. Gilligan said, quote, I love the BBC. I'm resigning because I want to protect it. I accept my part in the crisis which has befallen the organization, but a greater part has been played by the unbalanced judgments of senior judge Lord Hutton, he said. Hutton said the BBC was wrong when it quoted an anonymous source as saying officials had inflated intelligence to justify war. Besides Gilligan, the BBC's two top officials, BBC chair Gavin Davies and director general Greg Dyke, also resigned this week. And the BBC apologized to the British government after the inquiry.
Say, be everybody else, can't you see? You gotta be the. Ain't nobody just like you, you gotta be you.
Hit or miss, Odetta, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. From North Dakota to South Carolina, from Delaware to Oklahoma to New Mexico, seven states in Tuesday's Democratic primaries and caucuses span the country. In all, 269 delegates will be at stake at seven primaries and caucuses. Together, they represent more than 12% of the more than 2,000 delegates needed to claim the Democratic nomination. South Carolina holds one of the featured contests, the first southern state to vote and the first election expected to draw heavy participation by African-American voters, who comprise 37% of the state. Another state, New Mexico, is the nation's most Latino state. They comprise 42% of New Mexico's population, with a Native American population of more than 9%. People of color in New Mexico represent a unique population. They are a majority of the voters of the state. We go to both of these states right now. Jeremiah Johnson joins us. He is a reporter with community radio station KUNM in Albuquerque. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jeremiah.
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. And Deepak Bhargava, who is director of the Center for Community Change, which is a nonpartisan national group that's helping with voter registration and sponsored this weekend a forum on poverty and race in Columbia, South Carolina. All the candidates except Senator Joseph Lieberman, who was campaigning in Delaware, answered questions from the audience made up mainly of people of color who were low income. And welcome, Deepak.
Thanks, Amy.
Why don't we start in South Carolina? Can you talk about the forum that you held with most of the candidates?
Well, it was an unprecedented event for Columbia, South Carolina. We had 3,000 low-income, mostly people of color, participate in a forum at which each candidate was asked in turn questions about what they would do about poverty in their state. And each question was prefaced with a story about job loss or the lack of health care or the particular problems that African Americans face with discrimination or that Latinos face with immigration. And so what was especially interesting about it was that all the candidates felt obligated to come and to talk about their plans to address poverty and racial justice in the country. I think it's really been a remarkable experience to have a early primary in a place like South Carolina where the primary electorate is likely to be more than half African American, thus forcing the candidates who hadn't talked so much about issues of poverty and racial justice earlier in the campaign when they were in much less diverse states to address those issues now. And the forum was followed by 2,000 people going door-to-door in Columbia's public housing projects and in the shopping malls and on street corners registering voters to vote. And so we're hoping that it's the beginning of an effort to significantly raise the visibility of low-income people and people of color and get their issues addressed by candidates as we approach the November elections. You know, it's the first time I can remember a presidential forum where the questioners were poor people and the questions were about poverty. So I think just having had it is an encouraging sign that this issue in this constituency may play a much bigger role this year than it has in elections past.
It's very interesting that you should hold this discussion at a time when, well, the front page on Saturday of the New York Times headline, Democrats Assail and Tap Special Interests. It's by Glenn Justice and John Tierney. And it says the Democratic presidential hopefuls have been crossing the country this week, promising to drive special interests and influence peddlers out of the White House. But campaign finance reports show some contenders benefit significantly from the lobbyists and special interests that they attack. With Senator John Kerry regularly promises to stand up to big corporations, his campaign has taken money from executives on Wall Street and those representing the telecommunications industry, which is under his purview in Congress. Kerry denounces President Bush for catering to the rich, but he's depended more heavily on affluent donors than the other leading Democrats, except for another populist, Senator John Edwards. Kerry's spokesperson, Stephanie Cutter, said the contributions had no effects on his votes. Then it says, Edwards tells audiences, I've never taken a dime from a Washington lobbyist and I never will. The paper says that might be literally true, but not many lobbyists give dimes these days. Mr. Edwards has accepted at least a few contributions from current and former lobbyists. And his campaign manager was a registered Washington lobbyist in 2002. Edwards has also accepted millions of dollars from lawyers, including members of the Association Trial Lawyers of America trade group that wields enormous influence on tort reform. And an ex-president of the group, Fred Barron, is a financial co-chair of Edwards' campaign. The new president of the group and all four executives, officers have each given $2,000 to his campaign. Your response?
Well, there really are two kinds of power in America. There's organized money, which has been dominant, and then there's organized people. And so I think the challenge in this really toxic political environment where contributors and big donors call the shots, both about what issues are discussed as well as what the outcome will be on the discussion of those issues, the challenge for people who care about progressive values and social justice is to build a constituency that candidates cannot ignore, that goes door to door, that engages people on the bread and butter issues that matter to them. And so I think we've seen some movement over the past few months to hear the candidates talk in much more populist terms about the bread and butter economic challenges facing ordinary Americans, low-income Americans. And that's positive. It's undoubtedly still the case that money is dominant in shaping the national discourse and policy. I do think the candidates are increasingly recognizing that to win, they've got to expand the base of who votes. And to do that, they've got to speak to people who are disaffected and disconnected. And that means addressing issues that they haven't talked about before very much, like poverty and racial justice. So there's at least the potential, I think, for a different kind of politics here. But we've still got the shadow of the old politics dominated by money and special interests.
How present was Al Sharpton in South Carolina? He skipped New Mexico and was in South Carolina campaigning while the other candidates were in New Hampshire.
Yeah, well, he and John Edwards have clearly kind of staked their political futures on doing well in South Carolina. Reverend Sharpton has been making a big push. He was very visible. He has been very visible in the state, all over the state, as has Senator Edwards. Both of them have spoken pretty clearly to the issues facing South Carolinians, like job loss, trade, affirmative action, the minimum wage, poverty. Reverend Sharpton certainly did bring down the House on Saturday.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Deepak Bhargava. When we come back from our break, we'll be talking with Jeremiah Johnson in New Mexico. Deepak Bhargava, director of the Center for Community Change. The group held a forum in Columbia, South Carolina, Friday. All the candidates but Lieberman were there with people, low income, people of color, questioning the Democratic presidential candidates. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in 60 seconds. Rock Out by Art Ensemble of Chicago. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Jeremiah Johnson, you're in New Mexico. Can you talk about the caucuses that will be held there tomorrow? An unusual state in this country, a minority-majority state, 42% of the state is Latino, another almost 10% is Native American.
Yeah, this is the first time that New Mexico has been this out front in the primary slash caucus sort of election cycle. It was usually way later on in the year, and already, you know, who was going to be the presidential candidate for the Democrats was already decided in the past by the time New Mexico Democrats were casting their vote. But here New Mexico is out front with about 500,000 Democrats and about 10% of those Democrats expected to vote. So we're looking at about 50,000 votes cast. And as you said, New Mexico is a sort of a tri-ethnic or very multi-ethnic state. So you've got 42% Latino, you've got 9% Native American, and the rest is basically considered non-Latino and non-Native American. So the problem with assuming that the state of New Mexico is going to be the indicator for the Latino vote in the United States, and that's what a lot of Democrats have been saying, is that who wins New Mexico will carry the Latino vote in the United States. The problem with that is that, yes, it is 42% Hispanic here in New Mexico. However, that only comes out to about 800,000 people, and that's of the 35 million estimated Hispanics in the country. Another problem with that sort of indicator argument is assumes that somehow that the Hispanic votes around the country are going to be part of a homogenous bloc, making no distinction between, the Floridian of Cuban descent, the New Yorker who's also Puerto Rican, and the person from New Mexico is also Hispanic. The needs and interests of these different groups, because they're in such different parts of the country, are wildly different. New Mexico, the Hispanic population is for the large part, a rural population. So their interests and their needs are going to be very different from, let's say, a Central American community in Chicago. So that's one thing as far as the Latino vote goes, that the assumption that whoever takes New Mexico's Latinos will take the Latino vote for the rest of the country. And we'll see on Tuesday whether or not, that is sort of going to happen, because we're also looking at Arizona, which has a large Latino population. But we'll see whether or not that's the case.
And the Native American gathering that you attended, that you covered?
Yeah, the National Congress of American Indians got together about 2 months ago, and they get together every year, and thousands of Native Americans from around the country come and discuss issues from culture and tradition to issues like policy and policy making. And every single candidate, with the exception of one or two, came in person or came via satellite or sent some sort of video cassette message to the group saying that I will be the president that will represent Native Americans in the White House. And that's a tough sell. I mean, as you know, the federal government does not have the best record of keeping promises to Native Americans in America. And it's gone everywhere from, open conflict to sort of disregarding the treaties that have been made between the federal government and Native Americans. And those treaties have been, in exchange for huge chunks of land, the government has promised things like health care, and in the form of the Indian Health Service, which is in, very poor shape right now and is suffering greatly, and a lot of Native Americans suffer from, diseases such as diabetes and all types of social problems that the federal government really is not addressing, as it were. But the Democrats all came down, and they all said that they would be the candidate that will solve these problems, that will change this relationship. Now, the population, once again, it's a matter of population and symbolism. The Native American population in the country is only a few million. However, I think a lot of the candidates realize that in the past decade, or maybe just in the past 5 years, Native Americans have built incredibly lucrative businesses in New Mexico, is in the form of resorts and casinos that will allow tribes to vote with their pockets, vote with their wallets. So although they may not be strong in number at this point, there's a good chance that these candidates came out to the National Congress of American Indians to say, I will help you out if you help me out monetarily. So there's a lot to be gained by having the support of Native Americans. And the National Congress of American Indians everyone was very happily surprised, but wary and skeptic that so many of the candidates came out to Albuquerque then.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Jeremiah Johnson, for joining us, reporter for KUNM, based in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And you are listening to Democracy Now! This is Democracy Now! And for those who are watching on television around the country on Free Speech TV, Channel 9415 of Dish Network, or public access TV stations around the country, the music that our radio listeners were just listening to was actually the background of an ad that did not appear last night during the Super Bowl. It is an ad that was sponsored or created for a competition by the website MoveOn.org. And joining us to talk about it is Eli Pariser, co-founder of MoveOn.org. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks.
For those who could not see this ad, describe what just played.
Well, it's a very, very kind of emotionally resonant ad. It shows pictures of very young children doing hard work. They're working on a factory assembly line. They're vacuuming in a hotel hallway. And the only words in the ad come almost at the end. You don't really know quite what's going on. And they say, guess who's going to pay off President Bush's $1 trillion deficit? And then it just cuts to another kid working at a supermarket checkout counter. And so I think, one of the wonderful things about this ad is that it makes an issue, which is a very dry issue, the deficit, very compelling in an emotional kind of way.
So talk about this contest, Bush in 30 seconds, that you held. And what happened last night? Why CBS refused to air this ad? Were you actually going to be able to pay for it? The ads were more than, what, $2 million a spot?
Well, actually, we were offered the chance to run it for $1.6 million, and we were going to pay for it. We actually raised $900,000 from our members in about a day before we had to turn it off because CBS was saying, no, we won't run this ad. And so let me back up a little bit and talk about the contest. Bush in 30 Seconds was an attempt to get beyond sort of the same old stuff that you usually see in political advertising and engage some new talent in thinking about, what's wrong with President Bush's policies. And so we allowed anyone to submit a 30-second ad, and over 1,000 came in. And then people went on our website and rated the ads. And this ad, which is called Child's Pay, was the winner. And it's such a good ad, and it speaks to an important issue right now. And so we thought, let's take it to the Super Bowl. The Super Bowl is kind of, the premier venue for advertising right now. And CBS said, no, we won't take it. We don't take ads which talk about controversial issues. And of course, if Pfizer, the drug company, runs an ad that says we help people in need get the medicine they need, that's perfectly acceptable. But if we were to run an ad, that said Pfizer actually is backing this Medicare bill, which will stop seniors from getting the medicine they need, that wouldn't be allowed under this CBS policy. So it's a deeply problematic policy, and we were very unhappy that CBS censored us.
On Monday last week, Senator Dick Durbin said that the ban CBS is not allowing you to air this ad is, quote, Exhibit A in the case against media concentration. According to the publication Broadcasting and Cable, Durbin charged that CBS was refusing to run an ad critical of Bush in return for the White House's support for a higher media ownership cap that allows CBS's parent company Viacom to keep all of its stations. Durbin said the CBS eye has been closed to truth and to fairness.
It's I think what's interesting about this issue is that it's very clearly of concern not just to groups like ours but to groups across the political spectrum, because what it amounts to is a censorship of any kind of political speech. It used to be that you could go out on your town main street and protest. Well, now most town main streets are a mall, and the security guards can kick you out if they don't like what you're saying. And this is what we're seeing on TV now, that one of the last remaining venues where you can really talk about important issues is being closed down. And as the number of media companies get fewer and fewer, the opportunities to have a reasonable conversation get fewer.
But not everyone, Eli, said no to you.
Well, that's true. We're running the ad on CNN, and we're going to be running it nationally, and then we're going to actually take it to these battleground states where the election will be won or lost, and make sure that voters there understand what's going on with the deficit.
Are you going to be running some of the other ads?
Yeah, we will. I mean, what's wonderful about this contest is it's brought in such an amazing variety of content And you know, certainly we'll be running these as they're creative. They're totally unlike, you know, the usual stuff.
I wanted to go to another one, which is called "What Are We Teaching Our Children?"
If elected, I'll lie about weapons of mass destruction as a pretext to invade another country.
I'll call myself an environmentalist, then gut clean air standards.
Our allies will go from respecting us to hating us, and I don't care.
I'll leave no child behind, unless they can't afford it.
I promise to keep you in a state of fear and anxiety, so you never question what we're doing.
And if you do, we'll call you unpatriotic.
Bring 'em on.
And that ad said, "What are we teaching our children?" just before the "bring 'em on." These ads are produced by MoveOn.org. Yesterday, I was watching Chris Matthews' program, and he had Tucker Carlson on, the conservative pundit. And when asked about the ad and CBS not airing it, he said that MoveOn.org is a crackpot left-wing website, didn't have the money to air it anyway, just got a lot of news coverage, which is probably what you want instead of being able to pay. So that wasn't the case. You were able to pay.
No, I have to say, for the record, we're not a crackpot liberal organization. But, you know, I think this is what the right resorts to when it gets scared. You know, this contest brought out a lot of new creativity and a lot of new ideas. And, you know, that's very scary. And so they resort to calling names.
Talk about what MoveOn.org is. We're talking to Eli Pariser, who is co-founder of this website that has mobilized millions and I think instilled a lot of fear in some people.
Well, it's instilled fear in some people, but actually what we're about is bringing hope back into the political process. We've got 1.8 million members all across the country, and we help them take action on the important issues that are going on right now using the internet.
What does it mean to be a member?
Well, actually, you can just go onto our website, moveon.org, and sign up. And, you know, we take all comers. We don't charge an entry fee. You know, the idea is really that we're providing a service to help people impact the laws and rules that run our lives.
Now, you started as an anti-war internet activist. Can you describe what you did and then how MoveOn started?
Sure. Well, actually, I started a website after September 11th, which was calling on President Bush and other world leaders to, you know, think about the long-term consequences of their actions and engage in a multilateral way with the fight for against terrorism. And I just did this in my living room. I was just out of college. And over the next 2 weeks, 500,000 people came onto my website and signed up. And so, you know, and then they started sending me these emails saying, okay, what do we do next? And I was thinking, you know, you tell me. And that's kind of how I got involved in all this. And then MoveOn had been around for a couple of years, and we kind of joined forces. And those people were sort of the nucleus of our anti-Iraq constituency.
Anti-Iraq war,
yes,
constituency.
Right.
Now,
sorry.
Eli Pariser, what is your relationship, MoveOn's relationship with Al Gore? Because he's had given two major addresses, and both were sponsored by MoveOn.org.
Well, Mr. Gore actually just called us up and said that he thought that what we were doing was really important. It was engaging new people, and it was doing it in a new way. And he wanted to work with us. And so what he's been doing is really growing into a statesman for the issues that we care about. Every time he gives a speech, we're able to reach, you know, millions of people through the national media. And he's talking about really important issues that aren't addressed very much. He talked about Iraq. He talked about the environment and civil liberties. And because of his stature, you're able to break through what is a blackout of coverage on a lot of those issues, especially civil liberties and the environment.
Now, does the fact that he has endorsed Howard Dean mean that MoveOn.org has endorsed Howard Dean? It's also interesting that Dean is known for this internet creativity.
Right. No, we haven't endorsed any of the candidates because you know, our members. We actually asked our members, should we do it, and did a primary back in June. And the result was that no one got beyond the mark where we would endorse them. And so we're helping people connect with whatever campaign they wish to connect with.
I'd like to go to another ad right now from your Bush in 30 Seconds contest. This one is called Imagine.
Imagine a world where corporations choose leaders, put them in power,
and have them rewrite laws to increase profit.
Imagine a world where corporations start wars
to create increased demand for their products.
Imagine a world where the news media,
owned by these corporations, only tells the public what they want them to know.
Imagine a president who sells out his people and their environment to boost the wealth of a few.
Unbelievable? It should be.
And that ad ends with the word think. Eli Pariser, thanks for joining us. If people want to find out more about the website, moveon.org.
They go to the website. And also, if you want to see the ads, it's bushin30seconds.org.
Quick comment on the controversy over some of the ads that were chosen as finalists in this competition, having pictures or suggestions of going back to the Third Reich and Hitler.
Well, actually, those weren't the finalists. They were rated very poorly. And this whole thing was essentially RNC spin operation to distract attention from the really great ads, which went to the top. These were a few ads that certainly we wouldn't endorse. But it's kind of the way the democratic process works. You have some really comments that are in poor taste, and you have a lot of really genius. And our members sorted the good from the bad, and that's kind of what we expected would happen.
Eli Pariser, co-founder of MoveOn.org, I want to thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Also thought that a controversy was interesting in that one of the people running for Senate in the last race was Max Cleland, who had lost three limbs in the battlefield in Vietnam. The ads that ran against him had him morphing into Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden. You are listening to and watching Democracy Now. Back in a minute with Dennis Kucinich.
We want voting representation. 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 Voting representation, 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 voting representation.
Sweet Honey in the Rock here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As voters in seven states are set to cast their ballots in tomorrow's primaries and caucuses, some pundits are calling for the two staunchest opponents of the invasion and occupation of Iraq to be excluded from future debates, Dennis Kucinich and the Reverend Al Sharpton. In a January 28th editorial called Defrosting the Primaries, the New York Times editors wrote, quote, Representative Dennis Kucinich has every right to keep campaigning despite his minuscule vote tallies, but he should not be allowed to take up time in future candidate debates. Neither should the Reverend Al Sharpton, who's running to continue running, not to win. Kucinich has said he'll continue to campaign all the way to the Democratic convention in August. Sharpton has not indicated how long he'll remain in the race, but he is hoping for a strong showing in South Carolina tomorrow, where some polls predict he could get up to half of the state's African-American votes. Well, last week in New Hampshire, we had a chance to talk extensively with one of the people the New York Times doesn't want in the debates, Congressmember Dennis Kucinich.
Well, what does it feel like to be the most loved candidate by the peace movement in this country, yet perhaps the least supported?
I think it's inevitable that people are going to be supporting this campaign because it's the only campaign that's going to achieve an end to the war in Iraq and a redirection of this country's resources away from military buildups and away from war to a culture of peace and a culture where we can really work with the world community in creating a sustainable system of peace around the world.
I think your message is being heard, but people are simply saying they're making strategic decisions, like Michael Moore encouraging people to vote for Wesley Clark. Your response to that?
Well, let's look at that. Imagine the general election, the debate, President Bush, the Democratic nominee. Let's suppose that the Democratic nominee is someone who voted for the invasion. Well, the president will just tell them, well, look, you supported it. Where's your objection? Let's suppose the Democratic nominee is someone who has supported verbally the continued occupation of Iraq and the continued war. The president can turn to them and say, well, you supported the occupation and the continued presence of the United States in this war. If someone supported either the invasion or supports the occupation, they have nullified their ability to be able to successfully contest this president who is running for re-election on his policies in Iraq. I stand alone as the person who not only voted against this war as a member of Congress and continues to oppose it and the occupation, but who has a plan to bring in UN peacekeepers and to bring our troops home. So I'm in a singular position. And if you want to talk strategy, and if you're really thinking strategically, then people will know why I'm the only candidate they should be voting for to achieve not only a victory, but peace as well.
We're talking to Democratic presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich. Then why in Iowa did you and Senator John Edwards make a kind of deal? John Edwards, of all people, who did support the invasion.
Well, you know, a lot's been made of that, but let me tell you something. Everyone on that stage in Iowa, I had disagreements with on the war, period. And everyone on that stage I had disagreements with on health care and trade. So I was going to either have my supporters be standing there with no delegates at all when they had, you know, 10 or 12% of the vote with no one left to add us another 3 points, or I was going to be in a position where I was going to say, well, we agree on one thing, on having more delegates. And so, you know, I maintain the differences of opinion I have with Senator Edwards on all those issues. But anyone who's familiar with the Iowa caucus system knows that if you do not reach 15% of the people at a meeting and you need a couple extra points, you need someone to pair up with. Nobody's complained with Gephardt delegates who may have gone to Kerry. No one has complained about Dean delegates who may have gone with another candidate or another candidate gone with Deans. They've only complained about Edwards delegates who may have gone to Kucinich in a few precincts and Kucinich delegates who may have gone to Edwards in a few precincts. So, you know, this is the Iowa caucus system. It changes nothing in terms of this campaign and my position as the leader of the effort to not only stop this war, but to change America's direction.
I think the question is more, why did you choose Edwards of any of the candidates? I mean, Dean has expressed his opposition to war. Kerry supported it. Sharpton's expressed his opposition. He didn't participate. Braun had pulled out.
Well, if we're talking about the war, then what we should be talking about is the fact that Howard Dean has made many statements that he supports the continuation of the occupation. He has said publicly, we're stuck. You know, we're going to be there. I disagree with him strongly. That kind of thinking will keep America in Iraq indefinitely. And that's why I've presented a plan which indicates that the UN can be brought in if the U.S. is willing to give up control of the oil, control of the contracts, doesn't privatize, and doesn't try to run the government of Iraq by remote control, that there is a path towards peace. And Governor Dean has not pursued it. And so I've been very firm and consistent with my challenge. And so as far as I was concerned, there wasn't anyone to pair up with in Iowa if I was going to do it on the basis of where they stood on Iraq.
Congressman Kucinich, what about that March 21st vote where you abstained, the vote that many took to be a vote that legitimized the invasion right after the bombing? You, along with, I think it was something like 21 other Congress members, 11 of them said no, like Conyers, like Barbara Lee, like Maxine Waters.
To put that in the context of a vote in support of the war is fallacious. I mean, I believe I voted present because the question that was being put was, do you support the troops? Look, I support the troops right now. I say support the troops, bring them home. That's been my message. But the resolution itself was really about supporting George Bush. And so there were two questions that are posed simultaneously in the same question. One, support for George Bush. Two, support for the troops. And so recognizing that it was a trick question, I voted present.
Why not vote no like the others?
Because I support the troops. I've always said, let's support the troops. Bring them home. Look, I come from Cleveland, Ohio. There's a lot of people from my community who's serving out there. I want to bring them home. I felt this thing was wrong from the beginning. We never want to be put in a position where we cause the people who serve this country to believe that they're not appreciated, to believe that they're just pawns. I know that they should be brought home, and I'll never be in a position of having anyone, George Bush or anyone, try to wrap their arms around the troops and keep them at war.
Congressman Kucinich, you talk about UN in, US out. Explain exactly how that would happen if you became president today.
As President of the United States, I'll move quickly to repair the kind of breach which this nation created at the United Nations. We swept aside the UN process when we stopped the inspections. How much better it would have been for this country if we would have proceeded with UN inspections. We would have saved the lives of over 500 American men and women. We would have saved the taxpayers of this country over $200 billion by the time the president gets his next appropriation. And we would have saved the lives of countless citizens of Iraq who are innocent people. So my approach is this. I intend to go to the United Nations with a whole new plan, which sets aside American policies of preemption and unilateralism, a new plan which will demonstrate to the world community that we intend to stabilize Iraq through international cooperation. I will ask the UN to handle the oil assets of Iraq on an interim basis on behalf of the Iraqi people until the Iraqi people become self-governing. I'll ask the UN to handle the contract process on behalf of the Iraqi people until the Iraqi people can handle their own affairs. That means no more Halliburton sweetheart deals. It means the contracts will be open, a transparent process. There'll be competitive bidding. The Iraqis will be able to get jobs, which they currently do not have under the contract process. I will announce to the world community that the United States renounces any privatization plans in Iraq. That privatization is illegal. It's a violation of the Geneva and the Hague Conventions, and I will put an end to it because the Iraqi people have the right in self-determination to determine what should be done with the assets of their country, including protecting and keeping those assets for the people. And finally, I expect that the United States will meet success in going to the UN with a plan to have the United Nations develop a constitution and a cause of governance elections in Iraq, because the process that's happening right now will lead to violence, since this administration is insisting on a caucus-type election strategy that's aimed at trying to thwart the participation of a majority of Iraqis in their own future. That is going to lead to violence. 100,000 people marched in the streets of Baghdad less than a week ago in protest to the United States plan. We need to listen carefully, or we're putting our 130,000 troops at risk. The United States can help seal the deal with paying for a UN peacekeeping mission, with paying for reparations for the families of innocent civilian noncombatants who lost their lives, and paying for the repair of Iraq to the extent that we destroyed it. So my plan, the seven-point plan, will accomplish the conditions under which UN peacekeepers can come in and we can bring our troops home. It's the only plan out there like that. No other candidate has a plan. The president doesn't have a plan. I have a plan, and I will end this war, and I will reconnect America with the world community by telling the truth about Iraq and by stopping this preemptive unilateral approach to world affairs.
The other Democratic candidates, when it comes to the invasion, each of them said they believed that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction based on the evidence presented. You never did. Sharpton never did. But on that issue, what is the information that they had? Do you know what information was presented to them?
Fear. That's what they had. They had fear.
Given that you did not believe, based on the information that you assessed, that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, why not come out more forcefully attacking the other candidates on the fact that they said that they did believe, based on this information, and then go a step further, and that is call for the impeachment of the president?
Well, first of all, I find it, if you will check your own files, you'll see that I've been pretty consistent and challenging all the Democrats who have failed to recognize that there was no basis for the United States to attack Iraq. Remember, I led the effort in the House of Representatives in challenging the Bush administration. If you remember, there was in a presidential debate that I challenged Dick Gephardt directly when he said that he gave the president some advice. And I asked him, you know, it's too bad you didn't tell him not to invade. See, so I've met that test of challenging the other candidates. Now, you raise the question, and my presence challenges them. The reason why I'm going to be the nominee of this party is because as this Iraq thing continues to deteriorate, my candidacy stands alone as the one with the way out and as the one with the credibility and the integrity for having taken a stand where it counted inside the House of Representatives. Now, let's talk about impeachment. Impeachment's a sideshow. This is the big event, the election. And impeachment right now would only end up getting President Bush sympathy. It would be the politically dumbest thing which anyone should ever do. He's up for election. Impeachment lets the House or the Senate be the judge of a president. The American people are going to be the judge of this president. He wants to run for re-election based on his position on Iraq. I'm in the perfect position to defeat him over the Iraq issue, specifically because I can challenge him based on the credibility of my positions throughout this whole issue.
What about the media coverage of your campaign? We last spoke to you when ABC, it was the day after Ted Koppel in the presidential debate, asked you and Mosley Braun and Sharpton about your campaigns. And weren't these, I think you said, vanity campaigns, or were you really electable? And the next day, it's announced that the reporter who is covering your campaign and Mosley Braun's campaign will be pulled out, at least from following you in the campaign trail.
Well, you know, it is a great burden for a media executive to be charged with the responsibility of picking the next president of the United States. I mean, think how ponderous a decision that is, being head of a network and deciding who the president should be, why you have to look at the person's peerage, at their financial background, at the clubs they belong to, at the fraternities they've joined, at the reliability on the corporate issues. I mean, these are all things that weigh heavily on the decision-making process. I'm proud that I don't meet their test.
And what about the coverage here right now? What about the coverage in New Hampshire that you're getting?
I think the local media have done a great job.
Do you have any demands for the national media in this country?
Well, this isn't so much about me as it is about the obligation of the mass media, the broadcast media, in a democratic society. And I think it's important to have a perspective that goes back right to the beginning. First principles. First principles in electronic broadcasting in the United States begin with the Federal Communications Act of 1934, which made it abundantly clear that the electronic media is to serve in the public interest, convenience, and necessity. That was the test in the formation of electronic media and the licensing of broadcast media. We need to have a discussion in our country, in all communities, as to whether or not both local and national broadcast media meet the test of the public interest.
Congressmember Dennis Kucinich, Democratic president, Democratic candidate for president. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359. You can go to our website, democracynow.org. Tomorrow on Democracy Now!, Randall Robinson. He's written a new book, Quitting America, The Departure of a Black Man from His Native Land. And that does it for the show. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdel-Qudus, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill. I'm Amy Goodman.